This is Richard Ulyate. We are conducting an interview for the Veterans History Project, and today I'm with Neil Reinhart, and we're here in El Segundo, California on August 25th, 2012. Well, Neil, hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
And thanks for coming with us. Just a few biographical things is Neil served actually in a variety of posts, National Guard, the Reserves, and as well as the 101st Airborne. And was a sergeant, fifth class,
Sergeant E5.
Sergeant E5, okay, and also served in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. So, Neil, we'd like to know, first of all, what inspired you to go into the military?
Probably because I was raised during World War II, and just about everybody in my class joined the military when we got out of high school. I graduated in 1954, and I think just about all the guys I know went in the military. It's a thing to do.
So when you entered, where were you first based, or what kind of...
Oh, when I first joined the military, I was still in high school. I joined in 1952. In January of 1952, I joined the Colorado National Guard. And after being in the Guard a couple of years, I went to NCO school at Fort Benning, Georgia, advanced NCO school, and that's where I received the rank of sergeant. And then I served in various National Guard and Army Reserve units after that, until January of 1959, when I joined the regular Army. Thank you. When I joined the regular Army, I joined to become an MP, but because I had done some things people shouldn't do as teenagers, they didn't let me in the MPs. So I decided to be a paratrooper, next choice, and that's what I did.
Wow. Now, paratrooper training is probably pretty rigorous. What kinds of things do they have you do when you're...
Well, first of all, you get in good physical shape, and then they teach you how to fall. I mean, that's very important, knowing how to fall properly so you don't injure yourself. And then they, you know, teach you about the parachute, how it works and what to do and those types of things. I guess it's probably more rigorous than most. Oh, before I got there, before I got to the 101st, because I'd served in the reserves first, when I went to my basic training, I was what they call the acting platoon sergeant, even though there was a regular Army guy that was supposed to be. But I was actually the guy that kind of got him up in the morning and put him to bed at night and took care of him during the day. And that was the first 8 weeks. And then at the second weeks at Fort Sill, I did the same thing and was, they said I was honor graduate, but I think they just gave it to me because I was busy helping. I don't know. So anyhow, that was before I got in the 101st.
During that time, the late 50s, they were based here, you said, Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Right.
Were they ever deployed?
At the time, there was a thing called STRAC, which was Strategic Army something or other. I don't remember exactly what. But they took several American military divisions and had them on a standby basis to go quickly. And then they would take certain outfits within the division, okay, and that they would be on ready alert or ready reserve, I think it was. I wish I could remember better. And that meant that you had to be able to get on your trucks and in down to the airplanes and all equipment and all that stuff relatively quickly. And the only time that it happened to us was that we were out on a run, and they came out from the barracks and ordered us back and said, load up, we're leaving. And so we got our all our stuff on our trucks and went and got on the, when they took us to the airplane, it was the first time they'd ever issued us live ammo. You don't get live ammo unless you're going to, you know, a firing range.
Okay, wow.
And anyhow, they gave us live ammo and they stuck us on the airplane, and we sat there on the runway with the engines running waiting to take off, and then that went on for a while, and then they quit and we went back to the barracks. And we went, what's this all about? And then we found out it was when the Russians were building the Berlin Wall.
Wow.
And they were thinking about dropping us into Berlin. So that's as close as I actually came to going to combat.
Well, that's pretty close, because that was a very perilous time.
It was kind of exciting days.
It could have gone either way.
Yes.
That, and I guess Cuba later. So were you still in the service during the Cuban missile?
No, I'd just gotten out not too long before that.
Okay. Wow. So after you get out, were there some benefits or some something to help you, you know, education-wise, or?
I never took advantage of them. Okay. After I got out, I immediately got a job as a supervisor in an electronics factory in Colorado. Mm. And then a friend I'd gone to deep sea diving school with before I joined the military asked me to come to California and live with him while he went to college, and we'd go diving together. And I like diving, so I said okay. So the only thing I've used actually from the military has been the Veterans Hospital, which has been very helpful, VA health services. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't used it for much, but it's been nice to have when I have used it.
Right. I've been over there many times because of the Red Cross that I work with has a facility there.
Yeah.
The VA there.
Wow.
Yeah. So at that time, did you... keep in contact at all with any of your friends who went in the military at that time?
I tried to find some over the years. I accidentally found, I don't remember how I did it. I found a guy in Utah, and then he kind of disappeared. And then about 2 or 3 years ago, a friend of mine found my email address on the net somehow and emailed me. And it's been really great to be in contact with him.
Wow.
You know? So that's about the only guy, though, just one. I mean, I've looked for other ones on the net and stuff. I just haven't been able to find them, you know. I really regret, and I hope all guys in the service, I think now it's easier with emails and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I could look back, if I could have looked forward or known better, I would have gotten people's addresses, and I would have taken a lot more pictures.
Yeah.
You know, I regret that a lot.
So, when you were there, how many times would you say you jumped out of an airplane? What was the most exciting or the highest you?
Well, what you do is when you go through jump school, you make 5 jumps, and on your 5th jump, you get your wings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My next jump, my 6th jump, was actually one of the worst jumps in a way. We flew over the drop zone, and we got red smoke, which means you don't jump. Now, on the drop zone, in the stands, were a bunch of dignitaries and brass and stuff, and they wanted us to jump. So we flew over the drop zone again, got another red smoke. Went, well, we're not going to jump. And we normally jump from about 1,245 feet. Mm-hmm. And we went up to 1,400 feet, and we jumped. And we jumped much further south than we normally did. Mm-hmm. But yet we drifted over the drop zone, hit the drop zone and drug clear across it. We should have never jumped in those types of winds. It was very dangerous. A lot of guys got hurt. I broke my carbine in like 14 pieces, the stock, and I drugged for several hundred yards. I couldn't get up. Now, in those days, what you did is you're supposed to be laying on your back dragging, and you reach up behind you and you grab your chute and you flip over on your stomach and get on your knees and run and catch and get your parachute and collapse it. Mm-hmm. I couldn't. We were dragging too fast. Later, they got these things called capewell releases, which are buckles that go on the parachute that when you're dragging and you're laying on the ground, you're dragging, you can reach up and hit a capewell, and it'll let one or both sides of your parachute go, so you stop dragging. Okay. So actually, my 6th jump was one of the worst jumps. Yeah, that's kind of bad. Mass jumps were kind of scary because you got a whole bunch of people in the air at the same time. Mm-hmm. And after you mass jump, they heavy drop equipment. And sometimes the heavy drop equipment, the parachutes don't open. So that means the heavy drops streamer in. It happens occasionally. It doesn't happen often. But if it does, and you're in a lot of trouble, you know. And anyhow, I was coming down in the parachute, and I kept hearing this guy. This is a mass jump, a whole bunch of guys in the air at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hearing this guy yell, slip, slip. And I'm looking around in the sky trying to figure out where is this guy yelling from. Because if I can see him, then I can slip away from him, and we won't collide. And then I look straight up. He's laying on my parachute. And I'm going, oh, my God. So I just pull my risers down really hard, and that caused him to slide off. And luckily, we were high enough above the ground that his chute redeployed, and he made it safely. We both made it safely. You know? That was a little bit scary. Another time on another mass jump, I saw one. We jumped with things called PAE bags, which were bags that you would load with extra equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm a fairly big guy and was fairly strong at the time, I had a bag, I think, that had a bunch of rolls of donut commo wire, communications wire, and then we had shoved a machine gun down the center. So it's pretty heavy. Why am I talking about that part? Anyhow, the PAE bag, then what happened is when you're coming down, when you're X number of feet off the ground, I don't remember what it is, the PAE bag is attached to you by a bungee cord. Mm-hmm. And when you get a certain number of feet off the ground, about, you know, you can let it go sooner if you want to. You pull your two releases and the bungee cord falls and the PAE bag goes down below you and it hits the ground first and gets you to the ground. But yeah, this one time I looked over and saw one of my friends who was jumping a PAE bag and somehow the bungee cord had gotten wrapped around his neck. So when he pulled his releases, the bungee cord was wrapped around his neck and the guy was trying to hold the bungee cord up off his neck so he didn't choke as he went down to the ground. And he made it safely too, which is good.
Wow.
I did see one guy streamer in. That means his chute didn't open. It opened, but it didn't open. I mean, it deployed from the aircraft, and I'm sure he died. But I don't know who he was, and I didn't see him. And like I said about the heavy drops, one time a streamer, a bunch of, I think they're 5-gallon cans of gas on a pallet, streamered in. Mm-hmm. And it was about 20 to 100 feet. I don't remember. I remember it scared the hell out of me. Anyhow, it hit the ground and cans were flying all over the place. And another time, one of my friends, a canteen came down and glanced his arm. Somebody jumping after him had not strapped his canteen in tightly or fastened it correctly, and the canteen came out and just missed this guy. So, you know, it's we were lucky that we didn't suffer any real big injuries. You know? But geez, compared to combat, we didn't have anything, you know, it's nothing.
Yeah, some days it seems like it's almost as dangerous.
Well, guys get killed in training, that's for sure.
Yeah. And one thing you mentioned, too, about this is you said you grew up during World War II.
Yeah.
So you actually have a lot of experience in World War II, at least on the home front, because you were a child, but you were, you know, you could see what was going on.
Right.
What are some of your memories from there?
We were in South America when the war started, and we had to get on a ship to come to the United States, and we didn't get torpedoed or not, but anyhow, the ship had flags on it that says it was a neutral nation. And then we sailed in the ship to New York, and they were waiting to get torpedoed. It never happened. Good. So that's one memory from World War II. Another one is I had a wooden Tommy gun that somebody had carved for me, and I had a World War II helmet and a pistol belt and a canteen, and I marched in some big parade in Denver, and I was one tired 10-year-old when I got done with that thing. It was a long parade. Another thing from World War II was I was in the YMCA. And another YMCA guy and I got together and we won the YMCA paper drive, which allowed us to get our pictures in the Denver Post shaking paws with a famous war dog named Rin Tin Tu. Rin Tin Tu, yeah. And then we got a ride around Lowry Air Force Base in a Jeep, which for 2, 8, 10, 9 years, I don't remember how old we were, but for us kids, it was a big thing.
Sure.
I remember having to save all kinds of things, grease and gum wrappers, I mean, tinfoil. You know, we had to save that a lot. I remember rationing stuff going on with my folks because my dad had come back to the United States to join the military and they wouldn't let him because they said that his expertise in mining and engineering and geology was more important to the war effort than him carrying a rifle, you know?
Yeah.
So, he did that for what was called RFC at the time. I don't remember what that stood for. And later he was one of the chief geologists for the Atomic Energy Commission. But World War II stuff, let's say anything else. No, that's about it on World War II that I can remember. Oh, except when it was over. I can remember cars honking like, something else too. I remember when we'd go on trips and see trains, and it would seem like the train would never stop. It was so long, filled with tanks and guns and everything going west. We were in Colorado at the time.
Yeah.
And then, like I say, when it was over, I can remember cars driving around and honking and screaming and all that kind of stuff. But I wish I had more memories, but I don't, you know.
Yeah, well, that was total war. They had, did they ever have you in school building models of things?
No.
heard that.
No, I don't know. They never did.
Okay.
And I don't remember anything about blackouts either. I think that's probably because we're in the center of the country. I think had we been on the coast, I would have seen a lot about blackouts.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Well, that sounds like a very interesting set of experiences, you know, that most people don't have in
True.
Participating in even if they're Olympic parachuting.
Right.
And then, you know, coupled with memories of World War II. And you say you're involved in history and the study of that, or you obviously read, widely read on that.
Not bad, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, if there's anything else you'd like to add to this, I think this is a great record. I think people will enjoy, you know, hearing this, your own perspectives on you know, military during the 50s and World War II.
Yeah, I really enjoyed a lot of my military time. When I went in the regular Army, because at the time, regular Army guys did not like people coming in to the service with rank already.
Mm.
Okay, so even though I'd gone through NCO school, advanced NCO school at Fort Benning, Georgia, which was theoretically the best NCO school in the world, and I'd achieved the rank of sergeant, because I thought to myself, well, I'm such a good soldier, I'll make rank fast, I'll just go in as a private, which I did.
Yeah.
And in some ways I regret it, because I sure missed a lot of pay I would have gotten had I kept my rank. But I don't regret it, because I wouldn't have ended up with the same guys I did doing the same thing, you know? So it's kind of a mixed bag.
What do you mention, like, NCO school? Because a sergeant is very important in the Army. They're the guys who really get things done.
Well, NCO is non-commissioned officer school.
Right.
And a lot of places have them, but the one at Fort Benning is supposed to be the best one in the world. At least, it's the best one for the American Army, for sure. And maybe... I'm sure they have a lot of foreign students go through it, but it's basically the same. You know, I think it's a four-month course that you did. You know, you did map reading and all that kind of stuff, and we fired a lot of weapons, learned a lot about a lot of weapons, and it was very interesting.
Wait a minute, listen. Thank you very much for joining us here at the Veterans History Project. And this is, again, Richard Ulyate here with Neil Reinhart in El Segundo, California, on August 25th, 2012. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been enjoyable. Okay.